Hello and welcome to a new episode of my show. I'm Father Roderick, podcasting from the heart of the Netherlands, the city, the beautiful city of Amersfoort, where it has been a beautiful day full of sunshine and nice autumn weather. It's going to be a great week, and hopefully you'll enjoy the show. So sit back and relax. As always, this show is brought to you by my patrons over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick. Those are the people that help me finance what I do and help me also to create new ideas and to bring you these shows, pay the bills for the various services that we use. And your help would be very welcome too, if you can, of course. Go check out patreon.com/FatherRoderick. And for my patrons, I always record a special exclusive show. It is like a conversation after I've recorded this podcast. And patrons, as a thank you, can get access to that. And as soon as you become a patron, and you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month or more, if you can afford it. But you'll get instructions on how to get access to that podcast. But for now, let's take a look at the news.
Do you know what's going on? This is what's happening in your world.
They said Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
It's been an insane week for Tridio. If you listen to my most recent episode of The Walk, you heard me talk about this new project that I'm developing. A new channel, you could say, a new platform for a Dutch-speaking audience. And we're really trying to set this up with all the experience that we've gathered over the last few years working with Tridio. Now that we've made the decision to do this, it's as if everything at the same time falls into place. We've had a ton of meetings. We're going to have a lot of other meetings as well. Everybody that we talk to is enthusiastic. So it's looking good, and I'm super excited. This is like another step forward, and it's exciting because it's a very creative process. We know what we want to do. But for the more specific, let's say, the contents of the programs that we're going to produce, that's all still open. And so there's a lot of brainstorming and a lot of planning. We're really firing all cylinders at once. It's exhilarating. Sometimes it's also exhausting, because at the same time, I'm preparing my move from the current rectory, where I have the Tridio studio, to a rectory in a neighboring village. And that, of course, is a very physical process. I need to pack my bags and select what I'm going to take with me. And then we're going to use the rest of the house where I currently live for Tridio as well. So that will need to be refurbished and cleaned and also kind of reconstructed partially to accommodate all the new functions that this building will have, and a lot of it will be also media related. So I'm really not bored these days. It is an incredible amount of work. That's why I really, really am happy that every Wednesday I'm able to take some time off. Last Wednesday I went out for a long run. I'm still training for the Marathon of Amsterdam, and just being outside running in it was kind of cold weather. Fortunately, the heat is over, so that's actually perfect running weather. And just to be able to empty my mind, to also to think creatively about the processes that we're currently trying to manage, but also to just be outside and just run and only having to focus on my speed, it's great. And I also took advantage of this day off to go to the movies. So here's my review.
Not like movies.
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl, and that kid sees dead people, and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm gonna give it to you.
So this week, I went to see a movie that I had no idea what it would be about. The name was Alpha. I'd seen the movie poster, and I think there were some prehistoric animals on the movie poster, and it looked a bit like that other movie from a few years ago, where where they went back to the Neanderthals or something like that. And I didn't expect much of it. And I thought it was going to be, I don't know, two tribes. I had not even seen a trailer of this. And so I went to see Alpha completely blank. It was a 3D movie. And I was immediately hooked by the story. This was not at all what I expected this to be. Actually, you could say that this is a very conventional movie about a man and his dog. You know, on the BBC, they've got a lot of television series like that. The man and his dog, and it follows so-and-so with his poodle, and he's going to take a walk and tell you all about this wonderful dog that he has and how he's been groomed and does all these tricks, and it's wonderful. Well, this is kind of a similar story. It's about a boy, and in this case, it's not a dog, but it's, let's say, the predecessor of the dog. And of course, the dogs that we currently love and use as domestic animals are actually wolves originally. They're domesticated wolves. And over time, generation by generation, these wolves have become accustomed to human company. Their character has changed, even physically, by breeding and lots of generations of breeding. We've created all these different types of dogs. But originally, of course, these were predators. These were very dangerous, big animals. And so this story is about a boy who lives 20,000 years ago, when there were still lots of animals roaming the planet that now are extinct. And the world was rough. I mean, this is, of course, not the dinosaur time, but it's really ancient history, 20,000 years ago. I mean, when I preach and I talk about Jesus, and that's 2,000 years ago, that already feels like, whoa, that's really a long time ago. The world was so different, let alone 20,000 years ago. And the movie opens immediately with a very exciting scene in which you see a group of hunters, among which this boy that we will get to know later on in the movie. They are trying to hunt, I think they're bisons or something like that. And they want to kind of chase them chase them over the edge of a chasm so that they will fall to their death, and then later on they can just go down and have a big barbecue. So that goes awry. And then the story itself is about this younger member of the tribe. He's the son of the leader of the tribe, and everybody thinks that he has died at the beginning of the movie. Well, nobody knows that he actually survived the ordeal. And I won't give any details in case you still want to see the movie. He befriends a wolf. And this whole movie is about this growing friendship, this growing trust between this young man and this wolf. And then it shows you, it's a road movie, basically. They try to get back home. The wolf wants to go back to the other wolves, of which he's been separated. And then the boy wants to go home, but he has traveled for days, if not weeks, to get to where he currently is, and he doesn't know how to find his way back. And so the story itself is super simple. There is a bit of an exchange between him and the wolf, and he speaks. I have to say that in terms of the language of the movie, it is, I think, a made up language that is probably constructed to make us believe that that is how people 20,000 years ago may have spoken. So it's a completely made up language. But still, it's pretty well done. It's a bit like the Klingon that you see in Star Trek, where some of the actors just nail it. Or let's say the other constructed languages that you see in Game of Thrones, where they really want to make sure you believe that this is really how these people spoke. I have to say, for an English-speaking audience, it must have been hard to follow this, because here in Europe, we're very used to reading subtitles. And the entire movie is subtitled. By the way, in a font which is really icky. It's this yellow, it looks a bit like Times New Roman. It's like, subtitles are not supposed to be in that weird font, and it doesn't work. Who was the art director of the subtitles here? So, but anyway, it does work. But for the entire movie, everything that is spoken is subtitled, except for the beginning and the end. And the first voice you hear made me laugh out loud. It's like, oh, come on, again?
Because it's the wonderful dark voice of Morgan Freeman, the voice of God. And he is like, a long time ago. I can't do an imitation of him, but it was just so cliche in a certain way to have Morgan Freeman. And he's got like four lines in the entire movie. And yet he's on all the posters listed as, you know, one of the main actors. He's not even in the movie. It's just a voiceover. I wonder how much they paid him for that role. The main character, Cody Smith McPhee, is the actor who plays Kida. And Kida is the boy from the tribe who gets lost. And his father is also pretty important in the movie, Tau. And he's played by Johannes Haukur Johannesson. So that sounds, I don't know, Nordic as a name. He's actually from Iceland. Wow. And both actors are really, really good. The thing that impressed me most is how they filmed this relationship between the boy and the wolf. And I think at times they did a completely digital recreation, I think, of the wolf. Excuse me. And sometimes they must have used domesticated wolves. And it's very hard to tell what is fake and what not. And there are moments where I really want to see a special effects reel of how they made this movie. But because there are tons of scenes where you can't film that with a real animal. So it has to be animated. But then it's flawless. And you totally believe that the wolf is there all the time. And it's a very important role in a certain way because it's just a boy and this animal. So a lot of the acting is from looks. You know, you're projecting, I think, a lot of emotion on the animal because it's the emotion of the boy. And then, but it works. It really works. It's a fascinating story. It's the thing that I liked most about it was not the story, because it's actually a very kind of classic road movie with the everything is predictable that happens. But that's not the reason to go watch this movie. What makes it so worthwhile is the stunning scenery. The way they recreated this world, world of 20,000 years ago, and what the world looked like, and what the other animals... You see certain animals that are extinct, and but it's done in such a beautiful way. This is a movie that I think would be amazing to see in IMAX. We don't have IMAX here in Amersfoort, so I watched it on, you know, in the theater number one, which is the biggest theater, so it has a massive screen. But it's probably much better when you're watching this in 3D on an IMAX screen, because then you're really there. And there are just lots of scenes in this movie where it felt more that I was looking... that I was watching like a BBC Nature documentary. That's how beautiful it was. It's like, at times I was, is this real? Have they filmed this, for instance, in Iceland or in other countries? Or was this computer generated? I don't know. But it is, it's stunning. It's a really great, great movie to just sit back and enjoy the view. And when I left the movies, I felt like I had traveled back in time. And I'd been there in that, you know, 20,000 years ago. And it's actually surprisingly similar to the world that we live in. I mean, a story between a man and his dog. It's a story that you can tell no matter what age you live in. It always works. And then it's also the story of the boy who loses his parents and wants to get back home. That too is something that we can all relate to. And fortunately, the movie does not make the mistake of trying to bring in like modern day sensibilities and then reproject that on the world of 20,000 years ago. This it feels authentic. But this could have gone so wrong. For instance, when I first heard the English introduction by Morgan Freeman, I was like, oh, provided that nobody speaks English. Because that would totally take me out of the story if everybody was like, so, did you hunt some mammoths today, boy?
that wouldn't have worked. So the language itself really helps you to kind of switch off that critical switch in your head where you think, oh, it's all fake. And at times it's like you're watching really a documentary that was filmed 20,000 years ago with IMAX cameras. It's gorgeous. The 3D is also really, really nice. I would say it's not essential. The movie has been shot in such a way that you can watch it in 2D and still enjoy it. But because of the immersive nature of the scenery, of the world that you watch, the 3D definitely helps. So highly recommend it. The movie is called Alpha. It's been in theaters for a while now, so you may be able to catch it. And otherwise, definitely something to look out for on Blu-ray or on whatever streaming platform it will be launched in the near future. With that, it's time for some reading.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
I'm taking you today to my virtual library. And if you're watching the video stream, you can see behind me a bookshelves that look very much like the bookshelves in the rectory right now. Upstairs, I've got this big room where I used to produce all my podcasts, and there is an entire wall is covered with books. And I'm going to move to a new rectory. And I'm trying to declutter. This is a once in a lifetime, or probably not once in a lifetime, but a few times in a lifetime occasion to actually leave behind a lot of things. And the big struggle that I'm currently undergoing is, do I take my books with me? And first of all, I love my library. A lot of the books that are in my library are books that I bought when I was still studying philosophy first in Belgium, and then theology in Brussels, and later on in Utrecht. And over those 10 years that I studied, I have bought a lot of book of theology books and philosophy books. A lot of it, of course, are books that I used for my studies. And for a long time, I've kept those books. So I've got like Kant and Hegel and Husserl and Nietzsche and you name it. I've got all those collections, Plato, St. Thomas Aquinas. I've got, I don't know, like 4 or 5 shelves, and it's all Thomas Aquinas. The thing is, 2 years ago, I started this whole process of decluttering. And the principle, the gist of decluttering is only keep things around you that add value to your life. And try to get rid and pass on the stuff that you once bought and that has been useful for you, but is no longer, has no function in your life anymore. But it could still serve someone else. And so in that, when I was first learning to declutter, one of my biggest possessions were books. I had twice as many books as I currently have. And it's still a wall covered in books. So I don't know, I must have had at least a few thousand books. Of course, a lot of those books, most of those books, I bought them secondhand. And sometimes I got them for free. So it's not that it represents a lot of monetary value, but it is absolutely a reflection of the studies that I did. And when I went to my first parish, I built up that collection deliberately, thinking, you know what, as a priest, I need to continue my studies. I need to sometimes just read up on some theology and keep that gray mass active, because the temptation when you start working in the parish is, of course, to focus only on the pastoral work, and then forget that you also need to nourish your brain, your soul. You have to kind of keep current also with developments in the world of theology. Philosophy, of course, is, well, there's also a lot going on, but that's mostly stuff from the past that is still interesting to read. And then I had a whole new part of my bookshelf that was reserved for marketing books and books about technology. When I studied in Rome, communications, social communications, I bought a lot of books about directing, about producing radio programs, a lot of study books about mass communication and sociology and all the disciplines that come together in a study that is focused on social communications. So that too was for a long time. I figured I'd better keep that stuff because you never know when I have some time to read up on you know, the books that I couldn't read during my studies. And now, what is it? I went in. My last study was in Rome in 2003. I finished my communication studies. Since 2003, 15 years have passed, and of all those hundreds and hundreds of books that are on my bookshelves, I didn't touch a single one of those books. I did read a few books, mostly related to directing documentaries and some of the more like film video related books that I bought back then. Those were useful. But a lot of the knowledge that I needed to for my TV productions and for the podcasting is just by experience. It's just by doing that I learned the most. I don't really need books for that. And a lot of those, especially the books about communications and about technology, are now 15 years old. So they have no value anymore. A lot of the technology that they talk about is completely is in the past. Even the books about the about internet and about social media, that we didn't even talk about social media when I was studying in Rome. So a lot of those books no longer really represent any value. And then I have another segment of books that are dedicated to my hobbies and my interests. I've got a ton of books about Tolkien, of course, a lot of Star Wars books, and I even have a book signed. I found it yesterday when I was going through my collection, signed by William Shatner, and it's dedicated to Father Roderick. Now, that is a prized possession. It's one of my listeners that actually sent me that book that went to see him and got an autograph of Kirk for Father Roderick. I mean, that, of course, that is a book that I will cherish for the rest of my life. I'm incredibly proud of that book, even though I had nothing to do with it, but still, it's so cool. So I looked at my bookshelves. It's like, am I going to take these books with me? Also thinking about just the amount of work that it will cost to put all those books in boxes, carry those boxes to the new rectory, and then putting it on the shelves again. And it's like, why? I have not touched those books in 15 years. I read a lot. I read more than I've done in the 15 years behind me. But everything I read on my Kindle, including theology. During my vacation, I read the last interviews with Pope Benedict. But I bought the Kindle version, and there are a lot of books of, let's say, current theology. If I want to read them, I won't buy a physical copy. I'll buy a Kindle version because I can search in Kindle. I can do keyword search, and I can save passages that I want to remember. I love the function of just on my Kindle Touch or the Kindle Paperwhite. You just click a word, and then you can just click on a quote, and it will save it to the cloud. And it will also show you what other passages other readers have marked. Stuff I would never touch the pages of a real book. I always hated to get books on secondhand books where other people would have used yellow markers in the book. It's like, don't do that. That's sacrilege. You don't use markers in books. But on digital books, no problem. And it's actually really, really useful. And it helps me focus more on my reading when I do that. So with that in mind, knowing that I had not touched those books for 15 years, I've taken the radical decision to only take a very small sample of my books with me to the new rectory. A lot of the other books I'm going to keep here in the Tridio studios as reference books. So I've got a lot of theology where I think, you know, when we prepare, for instance, when we do preparation for a series, I don't know what kind of programs we will make in the future. But then, yeah, I'll just look it up and we'll have our reference library. And there are a number of books, I would say probably one third, where I'm thinking, I'm going to donate that to a seminary, to current students that are either studying theology or that are working on a thesis or whatever, there are probably a number of priests, young priests or seminarians, that could use these books for real. And I should stop telling myself that, well, perhaps in the future I will find some time to read Husserl or Heidegger. That's not going to happen. I know that for sure. And yes, I will read theology, but I'd rather read new books that are coming out. So the only books that I'm taking with me, and this was a very, very hard process, are the books that either have an emotional value for me. And there are a few books that I've read when I started my philosophy studies. And they were written by the rector of the seminary, who was also a teacher, a professor at the university. And he was a professor in metaphysics, in moral philosophy. And it was just one of those rare thinkers that can give you a complete overview of the history almost of philosophy and point the way to the truth. And he's just an amazing spirit. And nowadays, everybody has specialisms and they don't know much about other areas of interest, or they only know what they have specialized in. Well, and in the past, you had these great thinkers like Ratzinger is one of those last theologians that has this incredible broad knowledge of not just philosophy, but also literature and art and music and theology. And they will guide you through all those ages. And those books I kept because they don't write books like that today. And a lot of those books I've verified, is there a Kindle version? Well, for a lot of those books, there's no digital version, usually because they are published with publishers that don't have the money to make digital versions of that, because it's a very, very niche market. And these books are all in French. So they're for French theologians that are interested in, I mean, it's those books may have had, I don't know, 500 copies sold. And I have one of those copies. And, well, it's really, really hard to buy them again. And one of my rules is if I throw stuff away and I have still the lingering thought that perhaps I may need the access to this thing or to this book in the future, it still needs to be on the market. And so only the books that are very hard or very expensive to get, I'm taking with me. That's theology and philosophy. It's a very small selection. Then you're going to be surprised. You know what the first books were that I put in that box? My entire collection, the complete collection of Calvin and Hobbes comics by Watterson. Calvin and Hobbes saved me in theology when I was studying theology in Utrecht. Those 5 years of theology were tough because I had studied for 5 years in Belgium. And then I went back to the Netherlands, and that was at the height of polarization in the Netherlands, and studying theology was not fun. There were a lot of teachers where I had to reread the contents because I just couldn't really vouch for their orthodoxy and for the quality. And so things have changed tremendously over the years. But back then, it was a really strange world, the world of theology. And so I was doing a lot of extra study to make sure that I got my foundations right. And sometimes I would be completely exhausted. I also did a lot of stuff next to my theology studies. I've done desktop publishing for a Catholic youth magazine for 3 or 4 years. And it meant I did the desktop publishing for an entire magazine every month. And I would spend hours and hours, sometimes nights, entire nights, working with, Quark Express. That's probably for the old people among you. Quark Express was the desktop publishing program. And I was working on a Mac, one of those desktop Macintoshes. Extremely slow, extremely primitive compared to what now, to the kind of computers that we have currently. But it was a Mac, and I loved working on a Macintosh. But this wasn't a time that the only thing that Microsoft offered you was Pentium computers that ran Word Perfect 5.1, WordPerfect 5.1 was just a black screen with green letters. And for everything you wanted to do, even for italics, you had to type in, like, you had to press buttons and insert all sorts of codes in the text. It was a total nightmare. And I was already working with what you see is what you get type of software. So that's where I built the basis for my, let's say, my aptitude of working with graphics. I was already using Photoshop at the time. I was working with the earliest versions. And even desktop publishing, now that I'm building websites, still comes in handy to have that experience in how to do a nice layout. Anyway, I was working so hard that the only moment of peace, and I cherish those memories, was on Saturday morning. On Saturday morning, I'd sleep in. Normally, we had to get up very early for morning prayers and for Mass. But on Saturday morning, nobody was there. And I would read the newspapers in my pajamas, having toast, like a nice breakfast for an hour. I would read the newspapers, and then the first page that I always read on those blessed Saturday mornings were the funnies, the comics. And that newspaper had Calvin and Hobbes comics every day. And I would save them up for Saturday morning, and I would read all the Calvin and Hobbes comics that had appeared in that newspaper that week. And so I have this emotional connection to Calvin and Hobbes as my two friends that were always with me to get me through the week. And it was my reward after a week of hard work and study to be able to read Calvin and Hobbes that Saturday morning. So later on, when I was rich and powerful, I bought all the Calvin and Hobbes collections that I could find. Back then, there was no Amazon, so I bought them. I bought them in Amsterdam. There was one bookstore, the American bookstore. It's still there, and they would import all these books from the United States. And I would take the train just to go to that bookstore and to see all that. There was amazing books. We didn't have books like that in the Netherlands, and they had so much geek stuff, and they had comic books. And that's where I bought my first Batman Returns and Superman comics and Calvin and Hobbes. And so when I had to make a decision, what am I going to take with me? It's like Calvin and Hobbes. They are going with me. I don't want to part with these books. Plus, a number of Star Wars books. I got rid of the entire Expanded Universe collection that I had. I think I must have had at least 30 or 40 novels based on the now defunct Expanded Universe. So these books were all canon before J.J. Abrams came on board, before the reboot, basically, of Star Wars with the Force Awakens. And then when Disney took over Lucasfilm, they decided all that Expanded Universe, that's our playground. That's, we want to make movies in that timeline, and we can't have these books. And so they declared that an entire Expanded Universe, and I had invested so much time in reading the stories of Luke Skywalker and Leia and Han and their children. And I mean, it was an amazing time where it was the theater of the mind. You would read these books and you'd imagine how that would look as a movie. And once they relegated all those stories to the domain of mythology, basically the legends, it's called legends. I decided to get rid of that Expanded Universe. It's like, I'm no longer going to invest in that because none of that matters. It's no longer canon. And so I got rid of those books. But there are a few Star Wars books that I kept. One of them is based on an exposition of many years ago where it was about Star Wars and mythology. And it's basically a kind of a catalog, but it gives you an overview of all the mythological themes and religious themes in Star Wars. And I still use that book. Not on a daily basis, but whenever I talk Star Wars and I want to say something that goes beyond, like, oh, that's so cool, I look it up in that book of Star Wars and mythology. And so I've taken a few Tolkien books, not everything, but a number of books where I know, I mean, I've got The Dummy's Guide to Middle Earth. It's an amazing book. I'm not even sure it's being reprinted, but it's such a nice reference book to look things up when you're studying Tolkien. Stuff like that. But I also have a lot of Tolkien on my Kindle, and I use that, and I read that. So all in all, I think I did an inventory, and I, if I would have taken my entire book collection with me to the new rectory, I would have used, I would have needed probably 15 to 20 boxes. And please don't blame me for this, because I know I have a lot of book lovers in my audience, but I only am taking one box of books. One box. And it is a very random collection of books. There's this one science fiction book that I take with me. It's called The Asgard Run. And I read that when I was still in seminary, I think. And I loved it. And I looked it up, and it's not reprinted. The only copies that are around are on Amazon, secondhand. My copy, my paperback copy, looks better than the ones that they sell on Amazon. Plus, on Amazon, you pay like $30 for that book, because there nobody has them anymore. So I'm going to take that one with me, because I just love that story, and it reminds me of that. It's a story, I have reread that book several times, because I loved it so much. So, very weird, random choices. The only problem with this is, what am I going to put in my bookshelf, on my bookshelves in the new rectory? I don't know, but I do know that I think this is the right decision. I'm going to leave behind most of my books. I'm going to simplify, and it's even probable that 5 years from now, I'm going to look at those few books that I've taken with me, and I'm still going to get rid of them anyway, because life is too short to reread all those books. And if I have to make decisions on, well, perhaps, maybe, sometime in the future, if I do that, I will never be able to declutter. But I wanted to share that with you. If you have any tips on how to deal with books, how do you deal? Do you read digital books only, or is there something, you know, what is your relationship to the physical books? I'm always open for discussion in the chat room or on social media. Time for a quick visit to the Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
Here at the Peculiar Bunch, we're always happy to tell you everything you always wanted to know about Catholics and their world that you were afraid to ask.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
And today I want to give you a quick update on what is happening in the Vatican, especially now that we live in this time of crisis in the Catholic Church.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
Big, big news in the Vatican just the other day. Pope Francis has decided to bring together all the heads of the bishops' conferences from the entire world to bring them, to invite them to come to Rome for a meeting in February about the abuse crisis. I think everyone was waiting for this to happen. This is of capital importance, to get together with the entire church, because no longer can we say that this is a local problem. Time and again, almost on a daily basis, we are now reading these stories about cover-ups of abuse happening in Germany just the other day, in South America, in the United States, this is ongoing, and now in all sorts of, in India, you have these religious sisters that for the first time in their lives are daring to raise their voices and to accuse bishops that have used their power to do unspeakable things, and it's a worldwide reaction. It's almost, and this is, I think, ultimately so important and such a grace that this happens. It's horrible for the victims, but I feel that now more and more of these stories are coming to the surface. More and more victims are feeling empowered to tell their story and to be heard, and that is very important. It's very beneficial for the victims, and it's an incredible test for the Catholic Church. So everybody was looking, of course, to Pope Francis. How is he going to react when the accusations of Archbishop Vigano came out? Pope Francis said, I'm not going to say anything about this. Journalist, you do your work. You'll see what has truly happened. But I'm not going to say it. Perhaps I will say something later. Well, we've now also heard that the Vatican is preparing a statement or whatever communique about the accusations, about the allegations. And so they will also give clarifications. And I don't know at what time Pope Francis himself is going to address this in public. I think he's taking his time and he's being very prudent. I talked about that in the last episode. Prudence is a very important virtue in this overheated situation. But this news that he has invited all the leaders of the bishops' conferences from the entire world to get together and to talk about this with him is, I think, a major sign that not only Pope Francis, but the Catholic Church as a whole is taking this more seriously than ever. And what I want to hear, and who am I to ask this, but what I want to hear is no longer these talks where, and they used to do this, like when the scandals in Boston came to light, what you heard in the Vatican was, oh, it's a typical American problem. And then it happened in Europe and all these stories in Europe. So, well, it's the Western world that is to blame. But now we have stories from Latin America, from India, Africa. It's way too quiet in Africa. And I can tell you that if there is one continent where this is a massive problem, it's Africa. I've heard this firsthand when I was still studying in Rome. We had people that work in Africa that told us stories that there in many countries. Celibacy is a theory. It's something that is perhaps, in officially it's there, but in reality, there are almost no priests or bishops. Well, maybe overcharged. I don't know any numbers there or any facts, but I heard those people that live there telling us there are so many priests and so many bishops that actually have a family, that have a wife, that have a girlfriends and whatnot. And it's everybody knows. Nobody talks about it. So in a situation where the church is powerful, where there are these, where there is power that is that doesn't have to be accountable, where they are literally on the on top of the hierarchy, even in the culture, socially, in society, that those are the places where you can be certain that there is rampant abuse. And probably not that much. I mean, let's always put this in perspective. It's not different from other areas in society. It's not that the church is the only place where you will find abuse. It's everywhere where there can be abuse of power, and where victims are silenced and cannot speak up and don't feel safe to tell their story. So this is a worldwide problem that it goes way beyond the frontiers of the church. But the church, I think, has the obligation to tackle it first, to give the example of how you deal with this. And we need to work on this together, even if it will take decades, I think, to heal. But it needs to be handled, and I'm so happy with this decision of Pope Francis to bring everyone together. That's how the Catholic Church works. It's let's get everyone together. This is our problem. We all have a responsibility. It's not something that the Pope himself can solve. He has a position of leadership, but this is something that every single bishop, every single priest, every single layperson as well in the Catholic Church should consider to be their problem too. If only that we have the obligation to pray for the victims, to do whatever we can to create a safe environment, to make victims feel safe, to tell their story, to listen, all that. But also the bigger discussions. What has gone wrong in the formation of priests and bishops? What is wrong in our current structures that has allowed this massive worldwide cover-up? And how can we improve that? And I think that nothing should be off the table when it comes to this, because this is a structural problem, and a structural problem needs structural solutions. So for my part, I'm going to pray for this meetup and to pray for all of us and with all of us for a revolution in the church and in the world, because we need to work towards a world where there will no longer be this silenced abuse going on, these powerful structures that can cover up, whether it is in Hollywood, you know, in the church, or in sports, in the world of sports. We've seen it all. We know this is everywhere. We as a church have a responsibility to be on the side of the victims and to make sure that we do whatever we can to eradicate this evil from the face of the earth.
We are on the cutting edge of technology.
Time for technology. Wow.
Well, what does that mean?
Just plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device. And it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner build... Whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
I'm wrapping up this episode of the podcast while at the same time realizing that I forgot to press record on my recorder. So the audio that you're currently listening to is pretty crappy because it comes from the live stream. I apologize. Yeah, that's what you get. Sometimes things go wrong when my weeks are too busy. But speaking of technology, this was the week of the new announcements of the iPhones and the new Apple Watch. And there was a keynote, as usual. It's on the other side of the planet, so Pacific time. It's 7 o'clock in the evening, European time. So I was watching the entire keynote. It's about an hour and 20 minutes or something like that. It was pretty long, but with surprisingly few announcements. It's basically three phones. They all look the same. So one is a little bit bigger. One has an LED screen. It's basically the same kind of phone in three versions, plus an updated Apple Watch. And I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't get to see any new iPads or something else, like the wireless charging thing that they have been promising us for 2 years now. None of that. It's almost as if, again, they had to cancel a few launches because stuff wasn't ready. And so the phones are cool. I mean, most of them are like the second iteration of the iPhone 10 or the iPhone X that came out last year, and of which Apple said this is going to be the future, at least for the next few years, of what we want to do in the world of phones. Now, of course, the whole notch thing and the screen that covers the entire surface of the phone has been copied now by almost every Android phone producer. So it's no longer something that Apple can stand out with. Of course, what makes Apple so attractive to so many people is that it's the integrations, the quality of the software, and even more than last year, they emphasized, for instance, for the camera, how important software is. It's not just the lens, it's not just the technology or the sensor. It's all about the computational photography that Apple excels in, and the examples that they gave. I had no idea that they were even doing HDR and that kind of stuff on the videos as well. But nowadays, they're even doing that on video as well. 4K video with HDR, that is amazing. So am I going to buy one of those new phones? Well, you know where I stand. Apple, I can't afford it. It is too expensive. I think one of those models, the big iPhone X, by the way, the names... The iPhone XS Max or iPhone XS Max. It's kind of, I don't think that Steve Jobs would be happy with names like that. He was all about, let's make it simple again. But anyway, that biggest iPhone, if you take the heaviest version with the, what is it? Like half a terabyte. It's incredible how much storage you have on those new phones. But it's like $1,500. So that's like 1,700 euros. It's insane. People, you would pay that for a phone. The only phone that I was mildly interested in is the iPhone XR, which is a lower cost. It's still very expensive for a phone. I've never paid more than a couple of $100 for a phone in my life. That phone starts at $750, so that's still 800 something euros. That's really expensive. It's a slightly simpler version, but it has, even with one lens, still really impressive capabilities for photography and for filming. And I'm mostly interested in my phone for filming. I've learned during my Camino that having a good phone will enable you to make television quality footage. Shoot television quality footage on a simple phone. I've also seen that there are now microphone solutions, because of course there's no 3.5-inch jack anymore. But there are now Rode makes microphones that you can use with these newer models of iPhones. So that's a phone that I'm kind of interested in, but again, it's so expensive. So I first want to take a look at what LG is doing. LG is amazing with their Android phones when it comes to the camera. And gives you a super powerful control. It's rumored that the next phone that LG is going to launch, the V40, will have five lenses, five cameras. Imagine the creative possibilities. But then LG doesn't have the same kind of software updates that Apple provides. Apple, even phones that are 6-7 years old still run on the latest operating system. That is, I think, one of the reasons to buy Apple, because it lasts forever. And then you had the Apple Watch 4, which has a slightly bigger screen. It's got UV monitoring, and it's got, like, you can do heart monitoring. So it's a very medical device in a certain way, very much directed to fitness. Still, it's pretty cool. But it's not the revolution that will make me want to buy one. Again, those are pretty expensive watches. And even though I'm very much now using a smartwatch on a daily basis. I think for now I'm just going to stick with what I have. So it's my TomTom watch for running, and it's my Android, Wear OS watch for daily usage. And I'll just wait. But it's pretty cool to see that they keep developing the watch, and now it was the first announcement. So it shows you that this you know, the watch is getting more and more important. Plus, one final observation. And then we're going to start wrapping up. Tim Cook was emphasizing time and again how powerful the phone has become, especially the graphics. And there's so much computational power in those iPhones. You wonder, why? Just to take a few snapshots and to browse the web and to watch a YouTube video and to play the occasional game? These phones are way overpowered. And I'm thinking, this is the groundwork for what they're going to launch next year or in 2 years from now. It's this whole AR, augmented reality device, these glasses that they're developing. Because if you want to have lightweight glasses that can create a three-dimensional world and can be the next portable device that can be massive for Apple, you need a phone to power it. And that is why I think these phones are now so overpowered. Mind my words, 2 years from now, you'll see that I'm right. This is Apple is preparing, is laying the foundation for the next revolution in portable electronics. Well, that's my prophecy you'll have to stick around in 2 years' time. You'll listen to the show and you'll say, oh, Father Roderick couldn't have been more wrong. But for now, I think I am. Thanks for listening. Go over to the website tridio.com for all our other shows. And if you are a patron, of course, check out the after show, which I won't record right after this show because I've got my next meeting. I'll record it sometime soon. See you next week. Have a great day. And God bless.